household, what is the go-to TV show experience? Something. The thing that you and your significant other or friends or family members or just anybody who spends time with you in your house, what is the thing that you guys do when you can't think of something else to do? The thing you throw up on TV just because, I don't know, background noise makes us feel much more comfortable than being alone with our own thoughts. Here recently at Criterium Nation headquarters, that thing that gets put on the background as a means of just making sure that there is noise, something different than the fire engines going by our house periodically or the helicopters that seem to go low right over the courtyard, is Taylor Swift. We are Swifties. It is undeniable. I've fought that impulse for a year now, but I'm a Swiftie. God, I love some Taylor Swift. And I'm not a Chiefs fan, but whatever. Travis Kelce's pretty cool too. So when I had an opportunity to think of show ideas and topics that could combine my love of Taylor Swift with my passion of bike racing, I immediately thought of Taylor's great album, Reputation. It's kind of an edgier, a little darker, a little bit more sinister. It's definitely a reaction to what's going on in her outside world. And here we are at the beginning of 2024. It's April, so we're still calling it the beginning of the year. And we're having a reaction to what came before us. And we're in this edgy moment in time where one of our major races, Joe Martin Stage Race, has been postponed for 2024, but we've got a lot of other races and a lot of other racers who are ready to go. They're angry. They're focused. They're frustrated. They're unhappy with the fact that they've been sitting on trainers for far too long, and it's time for them to let loose, to unleash the fire and passion that burns inside them. I promise there's no snakes in this particular version of the show, even though Taylor's outfit that she comes out to in Reputation is just straight on fire, hot, great stuff. But we've got Jordan Chaney from Elevate, from Jelly Belly, from Project Echelon, from a lot of different great bike racing teams over the last 15 plus years as a professional, to talk to us about Reputation and about its value in the professional peloton, its value in the United States and North America, and just how your reputation precedes you, follows you, makes doors open for you, and in some cases, shut really, really hard in your face. Your reputation is who you are before you show up. The unique thing about Jordan's perspective is that he combines both persuasiveness and good points. A lot of times you get somebody who's persuasive, but kind of an idiot and just throws out stupid ideas. And you're like, oh, wow, that's great. And you miss the fact that his persuasion is covered by moronic idiocy. And sometimes you have geniuses who are out there who are just throwing off great points, but by and large, they're not terribly persuasive. And it takes a minute, but you start to realize that Jordan's legit. He's got some very good points. And I think that's the part that shocks me the most. My name is Rob Kelly. This is Criterium Nation, a show about life lived one corner at a time. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows, wideanglepodium.com. Go there for the full list, the bevy, as we oftentimes say, of shows available on the network. There is a donate subscribe button on the network, on that website, where you can go and financially support this show, Cyclocross Radio, Nowhere Fast, the Slow Ride Podcast, the Grodio, the great shows that bring so much information and intelligence to you and to your group rides. And I want to make a little bit of a pitch here. We're not reading ads anymore. Nobody is advertising for this space or this time, or just coming direct to you. And so we would appreciate it if you would directly support us. That's our funding stream. That's how we're keeping the lights on. We're keeping the digital player that's recording this and the hosting and all of those other things that are just the basic infrastructure that goes into running a podcast in a small, burgeoning cycling media company. So go to wideanglepodium.com. If you've not been there before, if you're not a subscriber, if you haven't donated before, please do buy us a proverbial cup of coffee or whiskey or beer, whatever you want it to be with that donation. I promise you, Alan, myself, everybody who's involved in the show will really genuinely appreciate it. So let's go back a few weeks to when I was in Tucson, Arizona, getting a little training in, working on my tan just slight bit, trying to find all of the best, you know, tacos that I could possibly find. Tucson, it actually is a UNESCO World Heritage Site for gastronomy, for food. It's legit. It's a great place to go and spend a few days or a few weeks during the colder months of the year in the rest of the country. And here I am on Jordan Chaney's back porch looking out at Mount Lemmon, and he and I are just shooting it. We're just talking about bikes, and we're talking about how bikes can be made better. And we're doing all of that right now. So normally I allow the guest to introduce himself at first, but I feel like with you, Jordan, I know you inside and out. You know, I've seen you on the inside.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like I can actually introduce you.
Oh yeah. Give me all you got, buddy.
No, I'm going to let that joke resonate and try to explain to the people who are listening the fact that 2 years ago, I got to be there like as the first responder to you with an open compound fracture to the forearm.
Yeah, wouldn't have made it without you, buddy.
I know. We can go all the way back to the beginning of our illustrious relationship. You know, your bones are really good looking, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I thought so. Yeah. You can have my bone anytime, buddy.
So you got me there. That's good.
Knocked him off track already.
Already, and we're only like 2 minutes in. You are and have been a bike racer at times in your life.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yep. But now you're transitioning, moving on, changing, just trying to stay fit and healthy through golf.
Yeah, well, it was a very forceful transition. You know, you can give me a little bit of credit. I was a professional for 8 years. It wasn't in and out of cycling.
Oh, so you were better than an elite Cat 3.
Yes, an elite, or even a middling Cat 2. I think I could probably have taken you at any time in my career, so to speak.
Doing research for this show, my favorite quote from anybody describing you is, he's 130 pounds, but he rides with the attitude of a 240-pound linebacker.
That's right. I don't know. Cycling, a lot of guys have big talk, big trash talk, and nobody can ever back it up. It's not like anybody's going to like push you off your bike in a race unless it's like musk on or whatever. But yeah, just use your voice and protect your teammates. And as I got older in the sport and certain riders wanted to mess with young sprinters and young guys that didn't know their way in the peloton yet, I kind of took that role. So yeah, I'm not really scared of anybody on a bike. In the street, I probably wouldn't say the same things.
But nowadays, and I don't know if people can tell the biting sense of humor that
yes,
you are displaying. You're a burgeoning comedian.
Yeah.
You had a paying gig the other
day. I sure did.
Have you officially made more money in comedy than you ever made in bike racing?
No, but within a few months, I think I should be able to top that plateau. No, yeah, it's been good. As I was saying, forced transition. It wasn't a grand retirement plan from pro cycling. I broke my back in the summer, and I mean, I'm still not really able to ride at any sort of level. But yeah, golf, comedy, you got to fill in the gaps. And comedy's great because you kind of get those same feelings of terror when you get on stage as you do when you're entering corner one in a crit. So
Do you feel like with the comedy that you kind of like work into it? Like there's a warm-up routine that you got to go through? And
oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I embarrassingly, for a five-minute set at an open mic, I probably sit in front of the mirror for a couple hours every night and practice it. And I don't know, some guys don't prepare, but I'm like actually so scared of get bombing that I think that drives me. And I don't usually bomb. I usually do all right. I mean, Eric seemed to like it, even though I roasted him pretty good on Wednesday. So that'd be Eric Hill of Echelon, by the way, the guy who fired me. And that was the impetus for my first 2 minutes of my set was that, you know, my coworkers were in the crowd and also the guy that fired me. So made for good humor.
Now, have you ever actually bombed, like bombed so bad that you're like, I should just pull myself out of this one?
Oh, yeah. The first mic you do, I think, is almost a guaranteed bomb. Like you're just going through it and like it's not like you're performing at you know, Rockefeller Center or something. It's a bar with a bunch of comedians that are actually purposely not trying to laugh at your jokes so they can keep their status in the hierarchy, you know. And I think I got like one giggle and the rest of the time they weren't even paying attention and I had to see myself off stage. So no, I came home that night and really questioned things, but you go back again, it goes a little better and you raise your expectations, you know. At first it was like if I could get one laugh in 5 minutes, I thought I was Chris Rock, but I think most of my jokes usually work now. You can still fumble your words and fuck it up for sure. But you learn to roll with it and improvise. And I don't know. It's just like a bike race in some respects.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a lot like bike racing in general. The first 10 races that you do, you are guaranteed to get dropped from all of them.
Yeah, and you can train as much as you want. And people always say, oh, you're so funny. I think you'd be great at it. And you practice, and then you do your first race and like, yeah, you crash or you get a flat tire, or you get dropped in the crosswind or whatever, man. It's a different thing. And you can, just like racing, I think, can only really learn how to do it by doing it. You know, you can't. I did take a comedy class, which I don't think helped very much. It led to that first bomb, probably instilled confidence that I shouldn't have had. And then, you just keep going out and getting your ass kicked, just like bike racing.
And yet we seem to love it.
Yeah, you love that. I mean, when it's good, it's good. There's nothing better than winning a bike race because it's so unlikely. You know, like it's just everything has to click and there's really nothing better. Then actually in comedy, you say you killed it. You know, if you actually kill and people laugh at everything and they legitimately clap when you get off stage, it's like, yeah, man, I have to resist posting up, you know, like I do on a bike. It's like that sort of feeling. And then just like in bike racing, you lose like the next seven races. You bomb, and you're just chasing that feeling. But yeah, it's pretty good when it works.
So the point of our conversation today is to go back to that quote. You know, the 240-pound linebacker inside of a 130-pound body.
That's right.
To talk about reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for it?
Yeah, as ready as I'll ever be.
That for those in the know who aren't millennial women, that was totally a Taylor Swift reference right there.
Yeah, I didn't catch it. I don't really follow Taylor Swift, of course, you know, because I'm a dude.
Yeah, well, there's going to be like five or six women who listen to this who will follow up with 1, 2, 3, let's go, bitch.
Oh, wow. Well, that's your demo, I suppose.
Yes. And it makes my wife happy. So that's what I really aim for.
Okay. All right.
So let's talk about reputation in bike racing. My thesis behind this, and you can tell me I'm wrong, and I encourage you strongly to, is that the reputation that you carry yourself with into each corner, out of each corner, into sprints, a lot of who you are as a person kind of dictates how easy your life will be within the peloton.
Yeah. No, it's something that definitely you start to realize as you go on and you become a professional. I think as an amateur, everybody has the same reputation, you know, until you win a race or do well, you're just another shit kicker making up the numbers and pros don't want to ride near you because you're not going to crash and ruin their race. But when you turn pro and you start to, you know, automatically when I was on Jelly Belly, people started to respect me or, you know, carry a certain opinion about you. Often a negative one if you don't do well, you know, all of a sudden it's like that guy on Jelly Belly that isn't good enough to be a pro, you know, but you start to make your way and And you learn a lot more at being a pro, like what makes the race work, because you're always in the hunt for a victory suddenly. And you sort of take a role and you develop. And some guys are just killers, you know, just right away. Like Tyler Stites, James Spicoli, these guys that I raced with, they have like dominated the North American scene. They get the reputation just because they earn it with their actions, you know. They show up and like if the wind's on the table, they take it. And for the rest of us, I think you try to earn a reputation as a reliable teammate, a guy that can win when it's his day, you know, back it up when it counts. And whether it's being a road captain, a voice on the road, or, you know, a guy sort of in the locker room, so to speak, that pumps the crew up or whatever else, you know, you find your role in the team. And I think in a lot of ways that's more important than on a pro team. Certainly having a good reputation and filling a role is more important than you getting 11th at Redlands. You know, as an amateur, that's sweet, right? You know, ninth place, that's great. But in pro cycling here, you know, you better be winning, or else you better have a reputation as a guy that a team would want to have around, you know?
You mentioned Tyler Stites. He is a phenomenal finisher of races.
Yes.
And he is not a boisterous person.
No.
If you hear him speak, that's not normal.
No,
you know?
No.
But everybody kind of holds him with awe and respect because of what he does on the bike. And it's interesting. What are the different types of bike racer reputations that exist outside of that dude's sketchy?
Yeah. Well, I kind of have a theory with Tyler that he was born with like 1,000 words and he's just using them very carefully as he goes through his life so he doesn't run out. He's probably at like 400 right now, so maybe on pace. But no, I mean, when you're that good, as I said, I mean, I don't think your reputation really exceeds you just being a winner. There's certainly guys, especially, I think sprinters overall can be the more boisterous type that will let you know that they won. I think Tyler will ride back to the car, hug his teammates, and collect his yellow jersey. But certainly you can get a reputation as a guy that's, you know, boisterous, like you said, and make sure everybody knows that he's there. But yeah, as you go through the sport, you know, you can get a reputation bad too as a guy that blows it. You know, I've had that in my life before. I've had a opportunity to win a GC, and for whatever reason, it falls through the cracks and you become a non-finisher, you know, and the team doesn't really want you to be solely in that position as the leader. And I was fine with that. You know, I was fine as being a part of the team and a second leader or, you know, whatever else. But yeah, you certainly, it comes from your results. It can come from misfortune. Like if you crash, you know, and it's a crash that happens in front of spectators, or it's a crash that takes 40 guys down, you're going to be known as sketchy, like you said. You know, if you can't ride at the front of a crit, you know, even if you're a strong GC guy, you get a reputation that you can't handle your bike and that you're not a real racer, you know, tons of stuff like that. You can get a reputation for being too much of a teammate. Like if you're the guy that is always on the front and puts his hand up and says, I'm going to ride for the team for the first 60K, and then you'll see me at the finish line or the hotel, you know, an hour later after the finish. You'll get a reputation as a guy that doesn't really want to win. And there's a place for that. I don't think in North America as much. I think in North America, if you want to be a pro, you have to be able to win when it's your time. But yeah, so certainly a diverse set of roles, like any sport, you know, locker room guys, quiet guys, team captains that lead with action, team captains that are rah-rah, you know.
What have you found to be the most effective for the teams that you've been on? I mean, Jelly Belly's a legend.
Yeah. Most effective. Well, I'm retired now, so I can talk about all of that. And Jelly Belly was, I mean, I can't thank Danny Van Hout enough for making me a pro, you know. Like I emailed him, I would tell the story of like the guys that want to get on pro teams. I have a folder of 15 emails that I sent Danny Van Hout, owner of Jelly Belly, director, during the 2015 season, no responses. And the 16th one, he said, like, will you ride for basically nothing? And I said, yes. And that was that. And so it was great to be on that team. Legendary team, like you said. But I never thought that really the team worked that well. We had phenomenal riders like Lachlan Morton and Sergey Chechov and a bunch of guys that had been in the World Tour came back. But I never thought that we really, I mean, we had team plans, but I don't think there was the right mix of roles on the road to ever have someone take control and be like, no, we're winning today. We'll follow this plan and adjust. It's so important. So yeah, I never found my voice there. I got good results and I got bad results. And eventually I had an opportunity to join Elevate in 2018, off the back of a good 2017. And there, Paul Abrahams, who I don't know if anybody's been on this podcast from Elevate, talked about Paul, but for me at least, the best director that I've ever worked with and the best director that I've ever seen in North America. Like, the guy changed the game for us. We'd watch game film, you know, we'd break down sprints at team camp and like really treat it like a real sport that way. And he would tell me, he's like, Jordy, you're going to be the leader today, you know, come back to the goddamn car and talk to me. You know, the first Hilo we did as a squad, we had the best sprinter, Alfredo Rodriguez, and we were sitting in the Peloton and the break had 3 minutes and we were arguing about whether to chase it or not. And eventually it became dire and we chased it, but we never caught him. And Paul reamed us out for about 4 hours and said, why did no one come back to the damn team car and talk to me about what to do? Like, this is a bike race, we're going to win. And from that time on, I sort of, I guess, blossomed into a leadership role. And it worked really well. We had killers, Sam Bassetti, James Piccoli, guys that could win any stage, any time. And we had guys that could really work and adapt. And a guy maybe like me that I've always felt like I saw the race really well while it was happening. And I sort of understood the statistics and the dynamics of what was going on. And that worked. Like, we won almost every race we did in 2019 before the pandemic. And unfortunately, that was the end of the program. But yeah, that worked. And I think when I'm directing a bit now too, I hope I can kind of bring that to the table and treat this like as maybe a world tour level of approach here in North America. So guys can develop and become that here before they need to go there, you know?
Is the goal still Europe? I mean, is that where the sport has to go, or can we? I know there's a Pez article that you've written, two of them now, the series. And you've been talking about, you know, the status of racing in North America, because you are Canadian, so we need to include that.
We do.
But, you know, is the goal still only Europe?
Well, you got to be honest about it. And that Pez series has been very illuminating. I talked to Eric and Gord Fraser and other directors for the first one about what they thought of running a team in this current financial environment in the sport. I talked to racers, you know, people that had gone over to Europe and come back, people that still wanted to go to Europe, and amateurs trying to make it. And then I'm talking to race directors as well for the next one. And you got to look at the numbers, you know, you got to measure it. Rob Laybourne was a good interview for this upcoming race director one. He's like, measure what you want, and you got to be honest about it. Like, okay, you're a pro in North America, what's the best you can do? And I'll tell you, I mean, without exact figures, I think the best you can do in this country is between $10,000 and maybe $30,000 a year. And that's it. That's not a living. I mean, anybody knows that. Anybody, bike racers listening to this will be like, wow, that'd be awesome. Like, I could be, you know, I could buy a condo. It's like, no, you can't. That's not a living. And there's some great races here, but I mean, do you really want to just race Redlands, Hila, Joe Martin, Tour de Beauce, and call that a life? For me, at least, and when I came back to racing in 22, even with Echelon, it was a great team, you know, but it never felt like I was a real professional because I was sitting at home for, you know, 48 weeks a year. Whereas before the pandemic, I was on the road for 12 to 14, you know, training camps, races, Tour Utah, Tour California. And so I think if you really are special, like Tyler Stites or a lot of guys coming up, Europe has to be the goal. It's not a choice. It's not a preference. It's like, if you want to race your bike and be a professional and have that be your full-time job, unless you want to train 48 weeks a year, you got to go. And yeah, I was fortunate to be in a time where, you know, from 2016 to 2019, when I was on those teams that, and even before that, you could be a real pro here. And there's guys making six figures. Like, Tyler Stites would be making six figures right now if he had been this good, you know, a decade earlier. And it's just not like that right now. It might come back. I really hope it does. But that's the direction.
What's the reputation of Canada, North America, United States when it comes down to racing? I mean, we lure sometimes athletes from
Europe to the United States.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the MLS.
Yes.
You know, like Wayne Rooney comes over and plays with the DC United for a season or two and then rides off into the sunset.
That's right. Well, certainly before, like I talked about, when there was some, you know, even mediocre money around, you'd see guys come back and UHC, you know, Rory Sutherland was a guy who raced for Movistar and, you know, and he came back and dominated. There's guys like that. Even Johnny Clark raced over there, came back. I don't think you're seeing that as much now. Maybe on the sprint crit side, you'll see guys come back and they can get good prize money, good, you know, good paycheck, reasonable paycheck. But I don't think that's going to happen much in the current environment in terms of the road scene. That's unfortunate. I learned a lot from guys that, you know, on Jelly Belly, there's like Jacob Rathie, Josh Berry, Taylor Sheldon. Those guys were on the Garmin Sharp development team before and raced in like Liège, Bastogne Liège. Josh won the U23 one, you know, and so that experience was so valuable. Now, who's going to be on your team that knows any better than you? That's a problem, you know, it's a problem. So, but overall, North American riders, at least in the World Tour races that I did, so on a Conti team, the reputation wasn't great. You had to really prove that you weren't going to screw everything up, drop the wheel. And obviously these guys are getting paid millions of euros a year. They don't want some punk on 10 grand to ruin their season. So that was tough, but we also have a rich history of great riders, you know, like Sepkus won the Vuelta. Canadians have been Mike Woods, you know, we produce great riders.
I thought Mike Woods was an American.
He's Canadian. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We traded for
him. You trying to start a war here? Or?
I feel like we traded for him. We gave you like a case of Labatt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no, he's an Ottawa guy, but I don't think anybody's seen him in Canada for a while. He lives in Spain, obviously. But yeah, that would be a good trade for you. I think for a few years, at least, he was the best North American rider, probably. Yeah, pretty special. And he's a guy that came up very late, and he transitioned through those North American races, the California, the Alberta, and performed really well at those that still existed and got spotted. And I think his breakthrough results, Tour Utah, he won a stage. And I don't know, he started late at like 27. I don't know if he could make it now from here. It would be a lot. He'd have to go to France immediately and start living in a barn and doing, you know, the races over there and, you know, yeah, all that. So yeah, it's a lot tougher now for guys like that. If you're good when you're 18, then sure, but it's tougher. So,
but when you showed up at Bose, for example,
yeah,
and you've got legit UCI European-based teams coming over, and you're in an American team kit,
yeah,
you know, even if it was Jelly Belly, did they give you the wheel? Would they get out of your way?
Yeah, I think, well, the teams that were coming over were obviously not World Tour teams, but very good riders, guys that you would know that race in the World Tour, but they were always respectful. They were on your home turf, and at least at that time, the North American teams were pretty damn good. Like, those guys weren't winning the race every year. It's not like Peo Bilbao won once in 2015. I guess that guy landed on his feet. But no, I mean, that was a good competition. You had South American riders, like Colombians, that would drive you nuts by attacking like 1,800 times in a race, you know. But it was that special. And Tour de Bos is more toned down this year in terms of international stuff. Like, Canada's still doing its COVID stuff and all that, or it was then. But hopefully they get back to that, because it was special, man, like having Spanish teams and Belgian teams come over and expose you to different styles of racing. Even that was great. So Tour de Bos is my favorite event, I can't lie. You know, I've talked to a lot of race directors and I love their events too, but Tour de Bos was the best for me.
But when I moved to DC, Clarendon, before it was Armed Forces, you know, in 2 days, it used to just be one day, and it was called the CSC invite.
Yeah, right.
CSC showed up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, the Bobby Julich era, you know?
Hey, you can't, like, people want to forget about Lance and, you know, call him an asshole, and maybe all that stuff's very deserved, but that was the Lance Armstrong effect, man. Like, I rode in a good time in professional cycling, like, in those first years, you know, you could make a living. But like turn of the millennium, when it was Lance prime, you know, time, that was the best. Like, I remember, I forget, maybe it was a Julich or a Hincapie or somebody I happened to listen to on a podcast, and they say every weekend they'd go out and race here before they went to Europe, before they did all that stuff, and they would make quota. And make quota was getting $1,000 each from the racing that weekend. That's what they expected. And they'd often do better than that. So plus their salary, plus, you know, plus. I think Matt Cook, who is a good rider here, told me when I was a U23 or something like that. He's like, man, if you win a stage of like Cascade or Redlands or come top five on GC, you're pretty much guaranteed to make 50 grand a year in here in North America. And I did all of those things in my career, and I certainly never got to that number. So yeah, things have changed. And I know guys like Rob are very circumspect, that Rob runs the Clarendon Armed Forces and want to get back to that level, but it's going to take a stepwise thing, you know, to get those guys back in America. And man, that'd be special. I think we deserve it. Like, the fans here are pretty awesome. You go, crits are the main cycling that exists now, but the fans are amazing. Like, you know, go to a NASCAR event or a football game. Like, that's the kind of energy you get here with the fans. When a race is sort of entrenched and been around long enough to be part of the community. So yeah, I really would hope for that to come back, but it's not going to be this year. You know, it's not going to be next year.
Going back to our original topic, you know, when you're here in the United States, and this is post pandemic, you know, maybe even just right before, when you're doing more with Elevate than you were doing with, you know, Jelly Belly, and you go into a corner in a Criterium, or you go into a technical section of a road race like Joe Martin,
yeah,
you know, is there really the pushing and shoving that they talk so much about in the films and documentaries?
Yeah, no doubt. I remember, I think probably the perfect example of that, and it ties into reputation, was my first year with Jelly Belly, with Elevate. I'd been on Jelly Belly, and they'd given me, you know, probably not the best thing for me in the end, but they'd always told me, you're a GC guy, just ride in the crits, unless it was a local crit, but Redlands, just ride, finish, you know, stay in the pack. And I never really developed that instinct to be at the front and get into that scrum you were talking about. And then on Elevate the first year, Paul drafted me last minute to go to Tulsa Tough, which, you know, and all the listeners know, is the craziest crits of the year. Super high speed, so many corners, just a bunch of crit guys and me, basically 130 pound against a bunch of 200 pound dudes. And I got bullied around. I saw the front for about a second in that first Blue Dome night, and then immediately somebody crashed, and I got, went back, and I never saw anything. And I remember coming back to Paul the first night and being like, I'm not willing to die for this. I literally said that to him. I am not willing to die for you, Paul. I want the team to win. I'm not willing to die. And he's like, you're not going to die. Don't be such an asshole. And by the end of that, I played a good role in the last stage with Cryberry Baby Hill. Obviously, the hill helped me. And I just committed to getting better at that and being part of that scrum. And I realized I could do it. Like, I have a fucking 900 watt sprint. You know, I'm not going to be the winner, but I got a strong engine, and I can be at the front, and I needed to learn how to handle my bike. I played a lot of Gran Turismo to like learn how to corner and stuff, and it actually helped a lot. And by the next year at 2019 at that event, you know, I was right in the middle of things we came back to in 21 rather. And I was right back in the middle of things at the front and using my voice. I think cyclists, you know, people, you don't want to say something truly reprehensible, but you got to make yourself big out there with your voice. You know, if someone takes your spot, you got to let them know that that shouldn't happen. It's not going to happen again, you know? And I don't know, maybe when I got onto Echelon, which is probably where that commentary about me being a lot bigger than my body in terms of what I say and do in the races, maybe that's where it came from. Cause I feel like I was riding with and around a lot of guys that were new to the sport post pandemic, new to the pro peloton. And they're surprised that somebody would do that, would put themselves in that situation when they're 130 pounds. But I had a job to do. And like at Elevate, we're not going to just win stage races. We're going to win every race we went to. And so that meant crits. Like, I came through the Redlands crit in 2019 or 18, I can't remember, on the front with a lap to go. And I remember maybe 3 years earlier, I was dead last punching tickets for 90 minutes during that race. And it's not like I got a better sprint. It's not like I trained myself into that physically. It's just, you learn to use your voice. You recognize the situation that you described, that it is a battle. You use your elbows, but it's a sport, man. It's not just an FTP contest. Like, you got to get out there and get dirty. It's a contact sport when it comes down to it. And, I embrace that. I really, those are the best times, actually. I never won a crit, obviously, but those are some of the best times.
So that Pez article, the first edition, it garnered a certain degree of response from the Criterium community that you didn't talk about crit racing in it.
Yep.
They did use a stock photo of a Criterium, but it wasn't even a Criterium because it was the Lion's Den race.
Yeah.
So it was a unsanctioned crit.
Are you sure you can say that's not a real Criterium? Is there going to be legal action from a certain section?
Who knows? But it wasn't sanctioned. Let's call it that.
Yeah, that's correct.
You know, and but it still was four corners and eight lanes wide. So, you know.
Yeah.
But you got a lot of flack from people from talking about not crits.
Yeah, and that was surprising to me because, and I don't, at the end of the day, the press is good press, and the idea of the article series is to get people talking, because when I talked to Richard Pez, Pestis, who is Pez and owns it, about the series, like I said, you know, I'm sick and tired of listening or asking the question about road racing in the US and North America, and the immediate response being, road is dead, but yeah, but gravel and crits. You know, yeah, but gravel and crits. And I was like, I want to talk about road racing. You know, I want people to have a detailed conversation and not just write it off as dead. And so that was definitely an angle I was taking. But also, I talked to three directors and owners of teams, and they didn't bring up crits. You know, I think a lot of people in this sport are from a time when road racing was very important and premier prime time, and they want to bring that back, and that's their mission. And not to say there aren't people that are passionate about crits, as I found out. Yeah, certainly found that out in the comments. But anyway, that's what my goal was. But I was happy for that response, actually. I immediately texted Marilyn Cullinan, I think, from Anniston, who was one of the commenters, you know, busting my balls, if you will, immediately. And I said, let's talk about it. And, you know, I'm talking to race directors for the next one. Let's talk about your crit. Let's talk about how you make it work, because it's all part of the same thing. Like, you know, crits, Rob Laybourne will say in the interview too, crits are road races. It's all road bikes, at least from the outside, as an entertainment package for spectators, which is what matters. Sponsors, spectators, it's all tied together economically. A crit is a bike race, a road race is a bike race. And so, yeah, move back towards that. But yeah, the crits are a different thing. And I think they're the survivors of this economic pinch we're in. You know, like road racing is probably the more luxurious item in terms of road closures, in terms of expenses, in terms of like spectators bang for buck. And crits are surviving, and I'm happy with that. Like, the sport has to survive, and I don't think without the idea of having crits here, I don't think it would. I think it would be all done. So yeah, respect to those people. And as I interviewed them, like, everybody has a different business model. It's pretty brilliant stuff. Like, there's some very good angles and that I never thought of. And I really hope that through the discussion that some of that stuff can be used to get road racing back on the prime time here in North America as well.
But can we, like, if you go back to pre-2010.
Yes.
Like, back into the...
Before Lance went on Oprah. That's the epoch.
Yes. And you would ask a rider from that time period.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who's winning races at that time. If you ask them, are you a crit racer or are you a road racer? Do you think they would just look at you weird and be like, no, I'm a bike racer?
Well, I think, you know, someone that's involved in Echelon as well now, and somebody that I've known for a while, is Gord Fraser. And Gord Fraser was the best sprinter in North America and at times abroad for a period of time there, and that, when we're talking about mid-2000s. And I don't think he was ever considered a crit guy. He was just considered the best sprinter, you know, and he did all the road races and won those, and he did all the crits and won those. And even on Elevate, we had guys like Sam Bassetti that won Winston-Salem, you know, a really demanding road race, but also won and could win Sunset Loop, but also won all the crits, you know, or he at least was podiuming them all. And I think that's a better situation for everybody, because it allows crit riders that are good in crits to get eyes from Europe. If you can win in a crit and a road race, it all goes together into a sweet little package of, like, you're a badass sprinter. But if you can just win crits, I mean, I hate to say it, and even Ethan Crane from Echelon, when I interviewed him for the Riders article, he's very honest about it, very straightforward. It's like, nobody in Europe is going to care if you won a crit, even if it's the biggest crit, even if it's Tulsa Tough here. They're like, you know, that is American with their crits, you know, it's not a real bike race. It's 60 minutes. And maybe they're right. You can't see the type of talent that wins a Tour of France stage in a crit. So I would love for it to be available, especially for sprinters. But overall, you know, strong guys can win crits too. That used to be a thing, right? Yeah, it used to be a thing that just road racers won road races, or road racers won bike races, and crits were part of that. So hopefully we can get back to that. I don't get the antagonism at all, to be honest. You know, I give those commentators credit for the conversation, but I really don't know why we're competing. It's not like crits are going to cost road races and road races are going to cost crits. It's symbiotic, if anything.
No, it's cyclocross. Cyclocross is truly the enemy, or is it gravel?
Gravel's the enemy. Yeah, gravel's for sure the enemy. I mean, no, whatever keeps selling bikes, at the end of the day, if bike manufacturers aren't selling bikes, they're not going to be able to do any of it. So that's part of it too, that we all need to consider. And same guys that organize road races often road race organize cyclocross and gravel. So, you know, whatever gets food on the table too, right?
So we're sitting here in your backyard, we're looking up at Mount Lemmon. This is just the question I got to ask. If you were to put, total sidebar, but if you were to create a Mount Rushmore of North American climbs.
Of climbs?
Yeah, let's say top four climbs in the United States.
Are we talking current or including races that have been then wiped away?
No, whatever you want.
Okay.
You go.
All right. Tour de Beauce, my favorite race. I think Mount Megantic is probably my favorite. And I think some truly special riders have won up there too. It's 5K, 9%, I think, with pitches that are like un-North American, you know, 14%. And it's always raining and it's always crappy. And there's actually always fans up there somehow too. That's a special one. Oak Glen was a big feature in Redlands the past several editions. I don't think it'll be in this year's, but it's also a classic climb. And Sepp Kuss went up there. You know, AJ August, I think, was featuring last year, and he's on Ineos now. That's a very, very good one. The entire Gila Monster stage in Tour Gila is definitely like one of the premier stages in North America. And those climbs go up to ungodly altitudes where, you know, I could never breathe and do well, but you got to respect it. I'm not American. There's four guys on Mount Rushmore.
There's four presidents.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll put Taylor Swift on there soon.
Yeah.
That'll be
fine. We'll add her. Let's put her like in the goalie stance and the, you know, lying along the bottom, something like that. Okay. But yeah, Tour California, you got to give it. That was one of the most special races ever in America. Biggest prime time, and got to give it to Mount Baldy. Like, I think Tadej Pogačar won up there. You know, I think Sagan managed to hold on to his race lead up there as a sprinter. And it's like a 2-hour climb that ends in 4K at 12% or something ridiculous up to a ski resort. A ski resort in California, it's got to be pretty high. And I don't think I ever finished outside the Gruppetto on that stage. I mean, side note, in California, we'd always joke that, you know, we climbed with the sprinters and sprinted with the climbers as North American riders. But yeah, that'd probably be it. Beauce, California, Oakland and Redlands, and the Gila Monster stage. I don't know. You can come at me in the comments. But if you say Crybaby Hill, I'm not going to take that seriously.
But put your coach's hat on for a minute, because you are a coach.
Yeah, peak form coaching, you know, look it up. Always looking for new clients.
I learned yesterday, because 45 years of life isn't enough for me to come up with this idea, and this is applicable to the Utah races, that as you get closer and closer to that, like, 5,500-foot mark, that your threshold starts to come down.
Yeah, it's weird how oxygen works, you know, pressure and whatnot in the air. There's certain guys, and altitude was always like an Achilles heel for me. Like, I was born at sea level in Ontario, Canada.
Yeah, it's like 600 feet.
No, I don't even, it's maybe 200, but in any case. not high enough to learn to adapt to anything. My first tour of Utah was actually 2010 as an 18-year-old on the Exergy team. And Levi Lightbimer was there, George Hincapie. It was a pretty big race, pretty hard race. And I went there and I didn't know anything about altitude. You know, I was 18 when I learned about altitude, not 45. But yeah, I, you know, some people have said that I have an intellect.
You're an early bloomer.
Yes, yes. Well, I found out the hard way because I went there and I'm like, why am I sick? Am I poisoned? Like, why do I suck so much? I can't breathe. Like, I was like, you know, I was thinking about, you know, did I eat something wrong? Or and then someone was like, yeah, you're at 8,000 feet, you idiot. That makes sense. And yeah, so I was never great at it, even if I did the acclimation, and that helps. I'd probably get halfway there, but guys like Lachlan Morton, it just didn't even seem to affect them. James McCauley, guys are special at altitude, but it definitely makes it a harder race because all of a sudden you're going slower on the climbs just because everybody's down that 5-10%, and it just gets that more grittier. You can make an acceleration, but you can't hold it for very long, and you blow up quite easily, and it's dramatic. And you go faster on the flats. Like Gila one year in the first hour, we covered 57 kilometers. So yeah, you go faster because less air resistant. But yeah, found out the hard way at 8,000 feet, huh?
I think it was closer to 6,000 feet when I started to really see my power go from this is normal to why I'm going to fall over.
Yeah, I always felt like it was like my fitness was gradually eroding from like a pro rider to like a cat three over the thousands of feet, because all of a sudden I was just like out of breath and I felt it's like 130 pounds, but I felt like I was, you know, a fat slob groveling up the climb, you know. Anyway, that's a tough aspect of racing. Even in Europe, like top of Alpe d'Huez is 6,000 feet. So, you know, you got to be that's one of the reasons riders in Europe go to altitude camps all the time. I think it might not be the only reason, but it's certainly one of them.
There's something there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the remote locations. It's tough to get drug testers there, but I don't know. That's probably not part of it. Cycling's very clean. No, you gotta laugh about that stuff so you don't cry. But in any case, there's very lots of science about altitude training, and it's a race dynamic for sure. Everything that makes a race harder, just like in car racing, you know, when it rains, it makes for a more exciting race. Even in cycling, when it rains, I think all that added difficulty when it's hot, when it's humid, when it's high altitude, it just makes it that much more exciting for the spectator, if not for the racers.
So put on your director sportif hat for me now and talk about riders coming to you to be on the team.
Yeah.
Somebody who maybe is known, maybe isn't known.
Yeah.
You know, how much homework goes into, you know, looking at a resume from somebody, and how much of the, hey, do you know this guy, is there?
Yeah, in terms of reputation, for sure. I mean, I'm in a development team role with it's Tag Cycling out of Vancouver, and it's probably one of the better U23 development teams in Canada. So I mean, resume is important because it is the best shop in town. There's probably, you know, Leslie Tomlinson that runs it probably gets 100 emails a month from riders wanting to be on the team. And I know Eric Hill is the same on Echelon, non-U23. You get so many resumes. So results are important. You got to prove that you can actually do it, that you're a winner. When I look at a resume or considered rider, if they've won a lower level race, I'm almost more psyched about it than them coming eighth in the top level race, because it's hard to teach winning. Like I said, there's just killers, you know, like Tyler Stites and stuff that just win. So that's I always look for that. Even when a guy's coming onto a team while he's racing, it's like, man, he pulled that off. That's pretty, you know, that's pretty cool. But yeah, reputation, especially in U23, which in North America is absolutely crucial now, because if you want to make it to Europe, you got to show talent early. At least that's the proven track. And so if you can't get onto a U23 development team, it's tough. And, you know, if you're a spoiled little brat, or you got a bad attitude, or, you know, you're selfish and only ever race for yourself at that stage in your career, you're not going to get that far. And I know that because I was a shitty little 18-year-old and I behaved badly on my first team in Canada. And sure, there's stuff that probably was coming back the other way that wasn't fair either, but I had to fight that for years and prove that I was a real professional about things. And so yeah, you just approach it like a job. You know, nobody's going to hire you if you're an asshole in the interview. And your interview is every race of the season. And there's 100 other guys watching you during those races. And if you're just a dick and have those bad qualities, it's going to be tougher for you. You're going to have to win everything to get a contract in that case. You know, you're going to have to force their hand. So it's much easier if you're good to your teammates, you know, build a good reputation, sell out for your teammates when it's appropriate. And yeah, that'll get you far.
Do people talk? Do the team directors talk to each other?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I've heard stuff about myself from team directors that I've never met before, you know? So certainly that's an indicator. And I've heard positive stuff too, you know, like, this is all part of Jordan's plan, you know, stuff like that I've overheard. And it's like, it's not really my plan, but I'm glad you think I'm the mastermind, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, 100% they do. I mean, they all have beers after the race. You think they're, you know, sitting in their hotel rooms and, you know, doing tactics all night. They're just having a beer and talking about the race. And even mechanics, you can get a bad reputation with a mechanic if you're a complete yard sale with your stuff, and that'll travel. And I've been there, done that too, you know. So you better be good to the Swan years. You better be good to your management. Not a kiss ass, obviously, that's not going to work, but good to your teammates. Everybody knows somebody. And yeah, it can only help, right? You can trash talk in a race, but you better, I always made a point of afterwards being like, you know, good race, man, like, you know, leave it out there on the course, so to speak. So,
you know, as a lawyer looking at resumes,
yes,
you know, I'm always looking at resumes and writing samples.
How often do you use that prefix as a lawyer?
As a lawyer,
you can say anything after that and it's impressive, right?
Yeah. But if I see a spelling mistake in a resume or poor grammar,
sure,
in a writing sample, like, I'm not going to really move much further past that, because this is your one page, two page document that you're showing me as like the pinnacle of my existence. Now, I'm not going to necessarily hold a bike racer to the same standards as a lawyer in the sense of like written work product, but like, are there clear no's that you see in resumes or in results that you're just like, nope?
Yeah, I don't think what you write on the paper is as important as how you sell it. You know, like, I honestly, in my career, and I raced from 2008 to 2023, so 15 years, I probably sent 200, 300 emails to directors, you know, like dozens a year. And I learned how to hit the right points, you know. People will write paragraph after paragraph about what they did, how they did it, their power numbers, this, that, their resume with the results neatly organized. But you got to sell yourself. And race directors often, they want a few things. They want someone that's easy to deal with. So you shouldn't come off demanding. You should, you should frame it in a way that you can offer something to them, not that they should give something to you. And then they want to hear that you can help them win. It's a business. They want to win. Their sponsors want to win. And they want someone that can represent their sponsors and bring something to the table. So I learned to say in resumes, like, I'm confident that I can win this race and this race. I'm confident that I can support the team. I did this for my teammate before. We won Gila, whatever. And I can bring that to your program. And that's all they need to hear. And the other thing they're looking for is not what you send them, but your persistence. They want someone that actually cares about this and wants it real bad. And like I said, you have to send 15 emails with the exact same goddamn thing in the subject line. You know, Jordan Shane resume, Jordan Shane result at this race. Jordan Shane desperately wants you to listen to him over and over. But that's a big sell, I think, you know. So you're not, I know guys that have said like, oh, I got this call out of the blue after this race, but I never had that, man. I had to hustle for every job I ever got. And I think that's more than ever, that's probably the case.
What do you think is the most underrated attribute for a rider who's looking to be spotted, noticed?
Underrated attribute. I mean, I talk with Leslie on Tag a lot about time trial results, you know, and obviously if you're winning time trial, that's not an underrated thing. But I think a lot of racers pigeonhole themselves really early. You're like, I'm a sprinter, I'm a climber, and don't care about TTs, never get a TT bike, never try to do it. And even though there aren't a lot of time trials in North America anymore that decide races or really, you know, at all, if I see a rider that can win a road race but can also come within, you know, 30 seconds of Zach Gregg, national champion at nationals, or, you know, come eighth place in Gila in the TT and then podium the crit the next day, I know I have an engine on my hands. You know, it's not just a guy that has great race craft and can sprint. It's a guy that can probably develop into an all-arounder capable of, because I got news for you. Mark Cavendish could drop your ass on a climb anytime. You know, that guy is actually, you know, really strong, and they all are really strong. So, you know, if you want to make it to the next level, especially as like an all-arounder type guy, you got to show that you can do it. And getting top tens in stuff that's not in your strengths range, you know, for me, I better win the climb and I better win the time trial, because I sure as hell can't win the crit. But if you're a crit rider and a sprinter, and you can show like, hey, when it counts, I can get up that mountain, that stuff, I think people look at. And yeah, so that's valuable. And also, don't be afraid to tell people, you know, you can't put in your resume, I was part of the team that came fifth in the Redlands Bicycle Classic. But you can certainly say in the sub or in the body of your email, you know, when we did this, like our team victory, I played a big role and I learned how to do this, and I can bring that experience, you know, that's valuable.
So what do you think is the takeaway for America's and Canada's, because we're intertwined and inextricably, you know, for the next step forward? Because we've got a lot of work that needs to be done to get to where we should be.
Yeah, I mean, that's no easy question. It starts at the foundation, you know, and writing this series at Pez and just being in the sport in general, it can be very cyclical. You know, you can have team managers saying, well, we don't have any races to go to, and race directors saying, you don't come to my race. And, you know, and riders being like, well, we don't go to any races with this team, it sucks, and the races suck, and Cycling Canada doesn't give me any money, which they don't, you know, and they don't recognize my talent. And so where do I go? And so it can be a blame game. But I think you got to find good people. You got to find people that contribute things to the puzzle. And, you know, I mean, Eric shit canned me off of Echelon, but I respect him because he seems to collect people that can add things to the program. And he interfaces with race directors and federations and brings things together to make a complete product for his riders, at least. And I think we all need to work together on that stuff. Race organizers would probably love to hear from teams more about what they need and what would be good for them, and vice versa. And I mean, maybe you don't bother talking to the federations, because I don't honestly think they'll be part of the solution unless things change. You know, there's only so much money that the government's going to put into this, and so many people that are going to be willing to help. But yeah, you know, we got to find each other's strengths. And I love it when racers come to me and ask me what to do. You know, I love that, sharing that experience, the directing special. Like, I'm not, when I'm directing this team, I'm not just taking my day rate and trying to give them tactics in the race. Like, I'm asking them what they're going to do for the season. Like, what can we work on together, you know, to help you get to that next level. And so hopefully I know there's a lot of people out there that are like that, and we got to incentivize them to keep around. You know, no one's getting rich in this business right now. And work together for the sport that we really are all passionate about, you know?
So final question here, shameless plug time for you. What is next for Jordan as far as reinventing bike racing in the image that you want it to be?
Oh, I don't know if I'm reinventing anything. I'm trying to maybe reinvent myself, but yeah, I mean, I've had my coaching business, Peak Form Coaching, since I was in college, since all through my pro career, just to like sort of make it economically viable. Like, I was never going to survive on that 10 grand a year. And that's been special. And I hope to work with more younger upcoming athletes to either, you know, coach them, physically prepare, but also help them figure this ecosystem out. I want to do that in directing. Like, I love directing, man. Like, as a team, as a road captain before, I just really love bringing that to the table. And I think a lot of teams can do a lot more and achieve higher results than they think, even with the budget they have and the riders they have, just by approaching it, you know, kind of like Paul Abrahams did in Elevate. Like, let's treat this like a real professional sport. So I hope to bring that to the table. I love writing about the sport. I love talking to the people involved. So with Pez and other outlets, I hope to continue to do that, offer my opinions for whatever they're worth and stir the pot when necessary, and maybe bring some nuances to the table that are productive. And yeah, I mean, if Eric can keep bringing the Project Echelon team to my comedy shows, that'll work too. They're a great audience. So
maybe next time he won't bring them to the open mic night, but to the paying night.
I don't know. Have you met Eric before? That was one of my jokes in the set was, I said, I don't know if I can roast Eric really, because I should be thankful he brought you guys to this show. I mean, he could have brought you anywhere in the world tonight, but he brought you here because it was free. I'm just kidding, Eric. But yeah, you know, that was great. And I think honestly, that shows a nice thing that's developed out of my career is that I can still be friends and enjoy the community after the fact and hopefully contribute. I'd love to help Project Echelon too, you know, anybody, any takers, you know, I'd really love to be part of it.
Well, Jordan, thanks you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for finally having me. I hope I don't have to beg for a couple of years for my next appearance.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of the show. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows. WideAnglePodium.com, your source for the full lineup of great shows on the network. Special thanks again goes to Jordan Chaney for being so frank, so honest, so forthcoming, and borderline loving. It's just a great time. We'll be back again in 2 weeks. Our next guest is Matt Zimmer. That's right, we're going back into the Project Echelon files to talk about the working man, the guy who gets it done, the blue collar guy, the guy from Iowa, Matt Zimmer, the man. Come back again for more stories from our Criterium Nation.